we are reconfigured. Justice Perry will be. Let me double check that. Justice Perry is participating. He will be listening to the tapes after the argument is made this day. Counsel is ready to proceed. Mrs. Creasy?
That's correct.
And if you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
May it please the court, I'm David Creasy. I represent Jamie Risher, Brianna Risher, Jacob Risher, and the estate of Robbie Risher. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for the conclusion. While I know the court has had an opportunity to review the facts, I would like to jump right to the main issues, as there are four and I do have limited time. There are four key issues that are before this court. One, does Nevada law recognize that a physician has a fiduciary duty in a physician-patient relationship? Two, does an advanced practice registered nurse also have a fiduciary duty relationship with a patient? Three, if a breach of fiduciary duty claim is brought, may one be brought independent of an NRS 41A professional negligence claim? And four, in this particular case, may the Rishers bring a claim, may they seek punitive damages? We believe that the answers to each of these questions is yes. However, in the district court, Judge Baer ruled that in each of those issues, the answers were no.
There is another issue that's of consequence, and that is whether or not writ relief is appropriate at this juncture in the case.
I'm sorry, would you say that again, please?
Yeah, there's another issue that's significant, and that is the propriety of entertaining this as a writ at all. I know that the court ordered an answer to that petition, and sometimes people think that's the end of the analysis, but it's not. So in addressing us, that issue would also be helpful to speak to.
Okay, and I will address that then, first of all. And the reason why it needs to be addressed is because, first of all, this is going to be an issue that comes up. I'm not going to say every case. I do multiple cases, many malpractice cases, but I do not bring this a breach of fiduciary duty in each one. But nonetheless, this will be an issue that is brought up repeatedly, and it would be helpful from this time going forward to know how the court believes whether or not these things exist. Second of all, to have us go through a trial, and even if the plaintiffs prevail, they would only be prevailing on their professional negligence claim. So my point is, regardless, this would be brought to the Supreme Court. If plaintiffs prevail and they prevail on their professional negligence claim, they would still be filing an appeal to raise the breach of fiduciary duty issue. And of course, if they lose in front of a jury, they would again be appealing to bring not just that loss, but a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
So your argument is that this is a potential issue of first impression, and there's a significant judicial economy in this case to resolve this point.
That is correct. And as I mentioned, no matter what happens with the jury, it's going to come to the Supreme Court. And so let's get this taken care of now so that by the time we do reach a jury trial, we can have all these issues already worked out.
This was decided, the briefs go back and forth, but it looks like it was decided as on a judgment on the pleadings, not summary judgment. So the district court was asked to make a theoretical ruling not particularly grounded in the facts, at least to the extent those facts weren't alleged in the complaint or discovered, right?
Yes, and in fact, one of the reasons why, with all due respect to the district court, I believe they were wrong, because under the 12B scenario, all the facts in the complaint were to be assumed true. And we believe that in light of those things, we should have come to a different conclusion at this stage in the litigation.
Is the record sufficient at this point for us to decide whether there's a fiduciary duty with a doctor or with a nurse?
I believe that there is, and I apologize, Your Honor. May I grab my water?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. We're always concerned at this stage on these extraordinary writs, whether the record is sufficient for us to make a decision that is, as Justice Hardesty says, is first impression, and we'll be seeing more of as appellate judges. If you could just respond to that.
Yes, and I think, you know, if we jump, if I may, the fiduciary duty issue as far as the doctor, I believe, was established in Hoopt-Hammergren. So I believe that the fiduciary duty does exist. That's what it says right in that particular case. The question then jumps into, does an advanced practice registered nurse have a fiduciary relationship just like...
Where is there any authority anywhere in any jurisdiction that says that, or it's been a holding? I know there's dictum on this issue, but is there a holding or anything that would support that argument?
In the context that we are looking at it, I don't believe that there is. Now, there's certainly that the defendants have cited some cases that they try to use to say that fiduciary duties do not exist in a medical malpractice type situation. Instead, they're subsumed. But the specific issue, do they have a fiduciary duty or not? I don't believe that there is a specific case. However, as we put in our brief, they're in the situation of an advanced practice registered nurse. They have some of the same and similar obligations, responsibilities, rights, and powers that a physician does. They can. Looks like you have a question, Judge.
Well, only because I was recently in Sunderland Hospital for a couple days, and I was wondering when I was reading this as to what the fiduciary duty of the nurses who treated me, or even the doctor who was there. What is the fiduciary duty of a nurse or a doctor? It's in this particular case, which is much different than mine, which was an infection as opposed to a suicide.
Yeah, in this particular case, I believe that the duty is that they have a responsibility to take care of the patient, to do the best possible job for the patient, irregardless of how it impacts them, primarily in a financial situation.
But isn't that just professional negligence? I mean, aren't we just talking about a medical malpractice case and to try to skirt around the caps,
okay,
by making it an intentional tort type thing?
That's right. And as far as what is the, how do we distinguish it? And I believe that when we made a change, we used to always call this medical malpractice. But we recently made a change that we called it professional negligence. And again, we're making an emphasis on the term negligence. Okay, I put it in my brief and I kind of called it, it's the oops case. It's the oops, I should have done something, I should have picked up on something, I missed something. Versus, in this particular case, what we have alleged is that there were intentional acts by the physician and by the advanced practice registered nurse that were not negligent, they were intentional, they were conscious decisions. And some of those...
The injury that was inflicted as a consequence of those actions is the same injury that's alleged as the basis for the malpractice claim. I think Justice Cherry and I were about to say the same thing.
Absolutely.
So my concern in this case, dealing with it on a writ based on the pleadings, in essence a motion to dismiss, motion for judgment on pleadings is very similar when it's early in the case. We don't know whether there is some aspect of fraud. I mean, Judge Baer quite clearly said if you have some kind of fraud claim, you can bring it back. It's early. But right now, if you laid it as a Venn diagram in terms of the wrong done and the injury alleged, it's a perfect match. I get that you're saying they had a financial motivation to breach the standard of care, if you will. But if the standard of care were okay with releasing this man to the bus trip wherever he went, you would still have no injury. So you need to have a breach of the standard of care in this case in order to have recoverable injury. There's nothing else. It's not like DeBoer where you had somebody notarizing some document for an estate case. And I mean, that's pretty far off the edge of professional services. And my problem is I worry about venturing in and writing something really broad before we know fully what possible nuances and facts could exist and might be brought back to Judge Baer through, you know, after discovery on a motion to reconsider this, to change the ruling. You're asking us to rule as a matter of law that on top of a medical malpractice claim, you have a breach of fiduciary duty claim, even when the wrong inflicting the injury
is medical malpractice or professional negligence, however you want to call it. Do you follow my question?
Yes, yes, I do. And what I can say is that, you know, I think Goldenberg, and recognize unpublished opinion, but I believe we're now at least allowed to say it and talk about those things. Goldenberg examined California's MICRA, which is what we have based our NRS 41A on. And as such, the law says that we can also, that we should also be adopting the things that they held. And they talked about a distinction between negligent acts and intentional acts. And we believe that the acts of Straub and Hickson were intentional. We allege that they were intentional, and on a 12B motion, they were to be assumed to be correct.
But, sir, every time you release a patient, it's presumably intentional. Say, hey, you know, you can go. If you do surgery on the wrong leg, that's a battery. That's an intentional tort. It still falls under that umbrella of negligence, and I'm having trouble drawing the distinction.
Okay. Well, but what I was going to try to say is that I believe it's under the Unruh-Haxton case. It says that you can still bring intentional claims, medical malpractice claims or professional negligence claims, as we call it, that are under the same operative facts. And when you have that, you can bring competing claims, you present them to a jury, and you allow a jury to come back and say, you know what, I'm sorry, with all due respect, Mr. Creasy, I don't think there was anything intentional here, but I agree with the medical malpractice side. Or they're going to come back and say, we do think, based upon the evidence that you presented us, this wasn't oops. This was not negligence. They intentionally discharged them, not because of any standard of care, or we believe, based upon our standard of care and our examination, that he was fine. We dumped him because he was costing us money. I had to do rounds on him. I had to check on him, and I'm not going to get paid. So get him out and let him go somewhere else. And that is the intentional component. There might be the same operative facts, but as under Unruh-Haxton, you can have same facts, but you can also allege and bring to the jury an intentional claim and a professional negligence claim. And indeed, I apologize.
So you're saying anytime there's an early release because the insurance company says you tear you out of the hospital after 2 days and don't let them stay 3 days, that it's a breach of fiduciary duty?
No, I'm saying... And you brought in an issue that the insurance company might be involved. There's no insurance company here. Straub and Hickson came to the conclusion there's cost and money. We can get him to Las Vegas Mental Health. Okay, they'll take him without insurance. But he came in on Friday evening, and it's now Saturday morning. They don't work over the weekends. So we're going to have to hold him. We're going to have to keep him. We're going to have to pay for this, and we're not going to get paid back. Get them out. And I mentioned that some of the things that go towards that is...
Well, that sounds pretty nefarious here, that the doctors would be plotting to do this to save money and all the nurse and all that. Is there any evidence of that? Or
well,
you're just drawing an inference here because of the day of the week?
Counsel, you are eating up any time you might have for rebuttal. You're at 225.
Okay. Let me just quickly address that, and I'll say whatever I can. The forms were not filled out. They were blank. Examinations that were to be done to determine he is okay to be discharged were not done. That's a difference between we did it and we made a mistake. We talked to him, we thought he was fine and he wasn't, versus we didn't even do it. So, and if you like, I'll then address anything else you're involved. Thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Jordan?
Thank you. My name is Erin Jordan. I'm appearing on behalf of Real Parties in Interest, Dr. Hickson, and Nurse Practitioner Straub. May it please the court, counsel. The most important thing that we ask the court to recognize here today is that the plaintiffs have asked this court to create a new exception to the cap on non-economic damages that is found in the NRS 41A-035. That is the entire gist of this dispute between the parties. It is of critical importance that we clarify the issues that are actually here for decision. There's been a dispute in the pleadings, and there's a dispute now and a difference of opinion regarding what is exactly at issue. What Judge Baer ruled was in this case, the claim for breach of fiduciary duty is duplicative and subsumed into the claim for professional negligence. Judge Baer did not rule that you can never bring intentional tort claims when they're qualitatively different from the professional negligence claims. Judge Baer did not rule that all professional negligence claimants can only bring that claim and they eat all the other claims and there's no way that you can ever bring an intentional tort claim. We don't dispute that. In some cases, if there are qualitatively different allegations, it is appropriate to bring a separate intentional tort claim. Those are rare. They don't happen that often, but it is possible. We're not saying that you can't ever bring an intentional tort claim.
Well, then why is this a good case for us to address this issue? We don't know what discovery may yield for your opposing colleague's client. And we don't have any kind of fully developed factual record. We just have the judgment on the pleadings. And I note you didn't oppose his writ on the basis that writ relief should not issue. You'd like us to give you a decision on this proposition of law. But that's troubling to me because part of the analysis of what would drive our recognition of a fiduciary duty claim in this context would be his advocacy based on more than in the pleadings, based on actual record facts that are developed following complete discovery, perhaps trial, perhaps asking Judge Baer to go back and refine his ruling. He clearly left the door open to this litigant to come back if he could dress it up in fraud allegations. And it makes me very uneasy when we're being asked to address things in the abstract this way.
I understand, and this is an appropriate case for decision for the specific reasons of this case. That what we are asking you to do is affirm a very narrow ruling. Just like I said, the issue before this case is whether their allegations regarding Mr. Risher's discharge were duplicative of his ruling or of their pleading of the professional negligence claim. And in this case, they're duplicative. So the ruling that we are seeking in this case is an affirmance that when you plead the exact same facts in a breach of fiduciary duty claim, as you do in your professional negligence claim, the breach of fiduciary duty claim fails to state a claim and should be dismissed in favor of the professional negligence. It's a very narrow ruling. We're not asking you to affirm a ruling that you can't bring intentional torts in any situation. We're asking you to affirm the ruling that, as pled in this case, they're the same claim.
Well, how do we know that?
Because of how
at this juncture.
And Your Honor, I apologize if I interrupted you there. We know that from the way that they pled the claims. A motion for judgment on the pleadings is based solely upon the claims. And they pled that they improperly discharged Mr. Risher, that he should have gone in for further evaluation and treatment and shouldn't have been discharged. They alleged that it was a breach of the defendant's professional obligations to discharge this man. And then because of the breach of the professional obligations, whether you want to call that breach of the standard of care or breach of fiduciary duty, it's all wrapped into professional obligations of these providers of health care, and both claims had wrongful death as the damages. The only difference between the claim is the reason that they allege that this happened. There's no factual basis for that, and we're not asking you to make a determination, and I don't think that it would be necessary to your decision to make a determination whether there was sufficient evidence of financial motivation. The ruling would be that it doesn't matter if there's a financial motivation because the acts and omissions are the same. The claim is the same. The damages are the same.
Well, it's just that there was a financial motivation?
No, I'm not. And they have very bare bones pled the allegation of financial motivation. Actually, if you look at their claims side by side, their financial motivation allegations are greatly focused on the hospital, who's a former defendant in this case.
Right, that's obvious when you read it, but yet you would like us to rule on this as being the sole thing that he has going for him on his fiduciary obligation claim. I'm puzzled reading the complaint how it's even alleged that these doctors and this nurse, or this doctor and this nurse, had personal financial motivation here.
And it's not, and specifically, it's alleged that he didn't have insurance and therefore defendants as a total encompassing the hospital who's no longer a defendant and us, had a financial incentive to discharge this patient. But it's not gone any farther. And it's failure to state a claim for that reason. They don't have enough allegations. And alleged motivation does not change the nature of the claim. And to go to my point of how they both allege a breach of professional obligations, there's a Nevada case called Stock that discusses this sort of issue. I would say it's a parallel issue in the context of legal malpractice. saying that breach of fiduciary duty and professional negligence encompasses the relationship between a lawyer and a client. And because of that, it's all encompassed in the professional relationship. And because it's all encompassed in the professional relationship, it's a claim for legal malpractice. And I think that the same type of analysis can apply to the situation before this court with their duplicative breach of fiduciary duty claim.
So, counsel, to Justice Pickering's questions, it's a bit confusing to me because the motion here was on the pleadings, but you agree, I assume you agree, that the district court left open the opportunity for petitioners in this case to amend their pleadings to allege fraud.
I would agree that the court left open their ability to file a motion to request that relief.
So what's confusing to me is the order that was entered in this case was a dismissal of the breach of fiduciary duty claim with prejudice. I just wanted to clarify that question because did the court, in entering an order that dismissed the breach of fiduciary duty claim with prejudice, preclude the petitioner from seeking an amendment to the claim, which I take a little bit more from the discussion by the court than perhaps you do. I think it was more than just to file a motion. But let's just leave it at that.
My understanding, you're correct, that it is with prejudice. And I believe that ruling...
But I want to know your position. Do you agree the district court left open in its ruling the ability of petitioners to file a motion to amend its complaint to seek a fraud claim?
Yes.
All right.
A fraud claim. And in response to the finding that this was not an adequately pled intentional tort, if there was additional evidence that arose regarding a fraud claim, they could seek leave to amend to add a fraud claim. I agree. That was
so wrong. Generally speaking, breaches of fiduciary duties are considered to be fraud claims. They're in the nature of fraud. What's the distinction here in this matter between a fraud claim, so-called, and the breach of fiduciary duty that was characterized as a fraud claim?
The difference here is that the plaintiffs, although they labeled it breach of fiduciary duty, they didn't plead breach of fiduciary duty. What they did was they pled a professional negligence claim, and we know that it was a professional claim according to Szymborski and DeBoer because it is a claim regarding medical diagnosis, treatment, and judgment. So it doesn't make sense and it doesn't fall into the boxes because it's not a breach of fiduciary duty claim, which is why it was dismissed by the district court, in my opinion, Your Honor.
So you would acknowledge, I didn't see any citing to the Humboldt General Hospital case, but in that case, this court, in that opinion, recognized that there could indeed be intentional fraud claims made or intentional acts. That was a battery case.
Yes, there can be intentional claims. There can be, you know, misrepresentation claims. And if you look at the Unruh case from California, that case was arising out of medical treatment, but not regarding the medical treatment. As they clarify in that case, they allowed intentional tort claims for the conversion or stealing of genetic material following fertility procedures. And they specifically noted that the reason that they allowed the intentional tort claim in that case outside of MICRA to escape the MICRA caps and limitations was because there was no breach of the standard of care. In this case, we come back to the fact that they're alleging that this medical treatment was improper, that they evaluated him and they found that he was not a danger to himself, and so they discharged him from the hospital. That's medical diagnosis, treatment, and judgment, and I believe that it is straightforward professional
so
negligence.
So your view of the narrow ruling that you're talking about from your perspective is that the trial judge in this case said that a nurse isn't going to be able to breach the fiduciary duty, breach a fiduciary duty because he or she does not owe one.
No, I think that in this case, the ruling, the narrow ruling, is that these two claims are duplicative, and we don't have to reach that issue. But in this, as you guys, as your honors know much more than I do, there is no case that states that you can bring a claim for breach of fiduciary duty against a nurse practitioner. The main cases discussing the fiduciary relationship between physicians and patients do state that the relationship is fiduciary in nature. They do not hold that there is a breach of fiduciary duty claim available for the provision of inadequate medical care. And that's important because plaintiffs are asking you to create a new cause of action, setting us outside of the provisions of 41A, the cap, the statute of limitations, and all that goes along with it, based on a duplicative claim. It would be perhaps a different issue should there be a different set of facts claimed, like we've seen in cases like Unruh. But here, this
there's a little bit of a distinction here. Maybe it's a distinction without a difference, but did the trial judge say that there's no claim for breach of fiduciary duty against a nurse practitioner, or did the judge say that all breaches of fiduciary duty claims against in a professional negligence, we'll say medical malpractice matter, are subsumed by the medical malpractice claim?
Neither. The district court did not rule either one of those. The district court said that when a breach of fiduciary duty claim is based on the same allegations as a claim based on medical malpractice, the breach of fiduciary duty claim is duplicative and subsumed into the medical malpractice claim. And I submit that that's different than both of those options, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And going back to my original point that this is a claim that is coming up more and more frequently in professional negligence claims and an admitted attempt to get around the cap. Oftentimes, allegations of financial wrongdoing are thrown into complaints without basis in an attempt to make this issue come up that we're outside of CODIN and we're outside of the cap because we've got an intentional tort now and it's simply a mislabeling and an end run around this chapter. A couple of remaining points that I would like to
Wouldn't it be better for us to actually have those facts? I mean, in terms of assessing this, let's say all you have is the speculation that they didn't have insurance and therefore they wanted to be moved. But would it be different to us if you had an email thread that said, get this guy out of here. He has no money. We don't want him. He's going to be a headache and a liability. Would that change the analysis at all?
No, it wouldn't, because in this case, the claims are the same. And so you may have this analysis, or you may have that email chain, or you may not. But an allegation of why they did that is not relevant. We're looking at what did they do or not do, and how did they violate their professional obligations to this man, causing his death. That would not change it. This was brought on a motion on the pleadings, and that piece of evidence, I don't believe, would change your analysis. I do want to touch.
So for analysis purposes, you would let us accept for purposes of argument that there was a nefarious email thread and there was communications about this person needs to leave our facility. We're in the red already. We can't host him. Please get him out and make false entries in his medical records that show that he could be discharged and shouldn't be, but we need to get him out. Assuming all those facts were implicit in this complaint, you would still say he has no fiduciary duty claim?
Correct. I would say that as a breach of professional negligence, because as a defense attorney, I would defend against that claim regarding saying, no, this email aside, this was appropriate and within the standard of care, and that's how I would defend that claim. And so the turning of that claim would be on whether there was a breach of the standard of care. And a claim that turns on whether there's a breach of the standard of care is a professional negligence claim. That analysis is set forth in a related, but there are distinctions, case of Pegram, the United States Supreme Court case that says these mixed type decisions that may have financial motivations combined with treatment decisions are decisions that are medical malpractice. They don't implicate the fiduciary duties of ERISA. Because they would be defended with breach of the standard of care. I'd also like to just mention that the punitive damages were properly dismissed. This is a straight negligence case outside of fiduciary, even with the fiduciary duty, because fiduciary duty is duplicative, and I submit that that was a proper dismissal. Looks like I'm out of time, so if you have any additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Chief, you seem to have one additional question.
Ms. Jordan, what affirmative evidence is in the record? Not just surmise. What affirmative evidence is in the record that supports this plot?
There isn't any.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Anything further?
Thank you for your time and consideration.
I'll just take a moment in response to a couple of things. One, if you look at the transcript from the hearings, Judge Baer clearly said, and the law seems to say, that it's subsumed for doctors, meaning the breach of fiduciary duty with NRS 41A, and it doesn't even exist as to nurses. It seems that's what the law says to me. So he did rule that there is no breach of there's no fiduciary relationship for an advanced practice registered nurse, which, of course, we disagree with. I wanted to go back to one issue again, and I know I'm beating the dead horse. Intent, intent, intent. That's everything. And according to the law in Nevada, intent is something that the jury decides. And again, there's a difference between, oops, I messed up. I filled out this form. I filled it out wrong. I mixed up patients. I had a limited time. I should have done a better exam. I thought I did the exam, and I didn't. That's professional negligence. When somebody says, I'm not going to see this person, when somebody says, the law under a legal 2000 hold requires a psychiatric consult, and I do not do it. When I am able to move them to another facility, but I have to hold them for a couple more days. When there are forms to fill out to determine that this person is now able to be released, and they're not filled out. When there's a box for you to sign verifying that you've done the examination, and they're now able to be released, and it's not done. When you start adding those things up, we're starting to move it from, oops, I missed it, to, I got him out of here.
Where's the evidence to support that?
Well,
you're saying they didn't do these things, therefore it's a plot to do something bad, instead of maybe they just messed up. Somebody didn't file a form. Somebody didn't see him. Somebody thought somebody else did.
Yeah, and the catch that we're running here, again, is that we brought up is it was a 12B motion. So when the motion is being heard, we're not able to do all the discovery. There has been discovery. And the facts about the forms that I put in my brief, okay, those came from our complaint. They're to be assumed true. There has been no variation from those. Okay, there's no testimony from a doctor in his deposition that said, man, I really thought the psych consult was done. That there is no evidence.
Where's
that
it the evidence that they didn't do these things because they're worried about paying for him? Where's the evidence that supports your interpretation?
And again, because we're at 12B, I don't have that for the purposes of the motion. But since then, we have done depositions, and we asked the doctor, Dr. Hickson.
Counsel, we're getting into an area that's outside your 12B, as you
okay.
put it.
That's
your
fair
final thought. Your final thought.
If I could just make one point about the punitives. The punitive damages, there's no case. There is not one case cited that said punitive damages are not permissible in an NRS 41A professional negligence claim. The standard is, can you establish in front of a jury by clear and convincing evidence that there's evidence of fraud, malice, express or implied, oppression? And we believe that we allege in our complaint, again, that's to be assumed as true, that there was those types of action. So to dismiss it on a 12B motion would be completely inappropriate, again, as I said, especially in light of the fact that there is absolutely no evidence argued by the defendants that there's any case law or statute that says in a Med-Mal case you may not get punitive damages. If there's any other questions, I'll address them. Otherwise, thank you.
No additional questions seem to appear. We will submit this matter subject to justice.